Get ready for Ready Radio with Doug and Amy. It's emergency preparedness for everyone. Brought to you by TruPrep. For all your prepping needs, visit TruPrep online at truprep.com or visit a TruPrep store in Roswell or Marietta. Listen in as Doug and Amy provide helpful tips on how to get ready for anything that comes your way. And now, your host, Doug and Amy.
Welcome, everybody. This week on Ready Radio, we have a special guest co-host. Amy is on vacation for the next week or so, and I'm really lucky to have Erin here. She is an expert in not only the prepper community, but also in homesteading. She's a canner and has been involved in small gardening and the homesteading community. She's an avid prepper and has been for many years, and is going to be a great addition to the show over the time while Amy is on vacation. So thank you for joining us, Erin, and I'm looking forward to our banter today as we go into a really interesting topic that's been weighing on my mind ever since our last show. I'm assuming that you had heard our show last week.
Listen every week.
And we were talking about the riots in Ferguson, Missouri. And I think that this is a really important topic because Ferguson is a microcosm for the U.S. And I think that this is a really something that we should focus on. And we don't normally go back and revisit the same topic sequentially like this. I mean, we try to give a breadth and a depth to our topics and give our listeners the ability to learn as much as they can in a very short amount of time. I mean, this is only a 1 hour a week show, and I feel, you know, the time crunch every time that I come on the radio to try to get as much information to people as possible. But when we look at what's going on in Ferguson, last week we talked about what do you do in a riot, and I think that that was an extremely timely topic as the riots got started. But I think that the way the Ferguson riots are going now, there's a second phase to this that needs to be addressed, and that's the problem of martial law. I think that Ferguson is leading more and more Americans to question, what is martial law? How could it affect me? And what do I do if it's imposed? Because as we see these riots become more and more militarized, I think that it's a natural conclusion to reach that martial law might be around the corner. And we see this so much in all the blogs, on the internet, and everything that's going on, that martial law is becoming a more and more... Look on the Twitter trending feeds, martial law is getting higher and higher up every week. And this is a concerning thing. I mean, most Americans have no idea what martial law is.
And most people don't even have a clue what martial law is. If you were to ask your typical person just walking down the street, hey, what do you think of martial law? They might look at you a little odd.
You know, that would be a great thing for I guess Jay Leno's retired now, but for jaywalking, just go up to the people like, so, what's martial law? And then see the responses you'd get. Because I don't think that people have any clue. I mean, they probably would make some kind of weird fusion between a legal system. Maybe they would say that it's a legal system for martial artists.
Hi-ya.
There you go. So, but the problem is you look at Ferguson. Look at what's going on there. This riot, and it has been going on for over a week now. The rioting is daily, every night, and they tried to impose a curfew and say, well, you know, if we keep people, because the riot doesn't happen in the daytime, it's not continuous. It flares up at night, and then it goes away in the daytime. There's like this regrouping period, and then it flares up again at night. And there's been a call to keep away from the daily, you know, the protests. They said protest during the daylight hours if you want to protest, because apparently the riot doesn't break out during the day, and they're trying to stave off what's happening. But look at the pictures. Look at the pictures coming out of Ferguson. Look at what the police officers are wearing. There was a point in time when we had a Norman Rockwell America and police were a different creature. They were somebody who was a part of the community and they were daily involved in the lives of the people that they were policing. Community policing was the norm. And there's been a movement to go back to community policing because we've gotten so far away from it. But I see that that is slowly dying on the vine. And there is a spirit de corps that has been fostered among the police, that there's us and there's you. And I've seen this among some of my best friends who are police officers. I saw a sweet young lady who was working at a grocery store, you know, making minimum wage, and decided she was going to better her life and better her family by going to the police academy and getting a job that she could support her children with better in the face of adversity. And I had nothing but the highest regard. But you know what? over the course of the academy and what she, the training she went to, I saw her continually distance herself from the people that she would be policing. And this is something that is trained. It's not normal behavior to try to separate yourself. This is learned behavior. And
they're trained to separate themselves. I mean, they're trained to not hang out in their local community at all. I mean, you don't eat out in your neighborhood because there's a bar in the restaurant in your neighborhood and you don't want to be associated with the bar. Therefore, you don't eat in the restaurant with your family. So those people start taking their family elsewhere. And then, you know, they make arrests and they get scared of these people harassing them in their neighborhood. So then they go elsewhere. But the fact of the matter is they're supposed to be upstanding members of the community and they should be able to withstand somebody harassing them after they've arrested them. I mean, it's just part of the job, and it's a job you have to accept the parts of, all parts.
Well, I'm going to disagree. I don't think that anybody deserves to be harassed, but I think that when the harassment starts, it's not the police officer's job to stop it. It's the community's job. If somebody is harassing a police officer unjustly, the entire community should come out against it and stand up for that officer and stand with that officer. But how do you get that kind of community support? You've got to be an active member of the community to begin with.
Right.
The only way you're going to get the community to stand up and to decry somebody harassing a police officer for doing his job is that you have to go to the church on Sunday. You have to go to the synagogue on Saturday. You have to go and to the grocery store and be there and help people, you know, with their groceries when they're, you know, going out to their cart, you see someone struggling, you help them. When you show yourself to be friendly, you garner the goodwill and the friendship of the community, and then it doesn't stand. Then the person who's harassing the officer is the one who's ostracized and cast out, not the officer. But the problem is that the police are pulling into themselves. And they're saying there's the community out there, and yes, we protect that community, but the only people we can trust are ourselves.
And that the whole brotherhood is just being further pushed. The police brotherhood, they are very centralized with who they associate with anyway. And when they're afraid to associate with their community because of the backlash from the community and the community not standing up for them while they're standing up for the community, then they just kind of group together and don't associate with the community any longer. And then that breeds the mistrust that's going on
in Ferguson and
exactly.
Elsewhere. And we see that. There was a study that I was listening to on NPR this last week where they said that in communities of color, 80% of the people believe that they are not treated fairly by the criminal justice system or police officers. 80%. So as we look at what does that mean, how can you have a community stand behind you if 8 out of 10 people, 4 out of 5 people turn around and say, we don't think that we're being treated fairly? I mean, that's a huge problem. And when that sort of collective angst is brought up and collectivized, when it's brought to the forefront, that's where these riots come from. Everyone wants to say, well, it's the riots because the police either shot, you know, this young man inappropriately, or they turn around and say, well, you know, it's because, you know, he was doing something wrong and the police had to stop him. Whatever side you take on it, this riot is not about a police-involved shooting.
Well, we have to also remember that a lot of this still stems from the same kind of riots that happened in the 60s, where the stories have been passed from generation to generation about what happened with the civil unrest of the 60s and the movements for equality. And these people, they sit and they say, oh, well, we can't trust the police because the police did not help us in the 60s. That same thinking has moved forward. But see, that's understandable with the minorities. But see, you also have other racial groups that are beginning to have the same kind of paradigm shift to believe that they also cannot trust the police.
And it's moving beyond simple race. Now it's becoming a class issue. And I think that's the bigger problem going into this, because as we look at, you know, multifaceted communities, you have people of all, from all ethnic backgrounds, from different nationalities, who are all living in the same area, but who all suffer from the common thread of poverty. And I don't think that the poverty that this nation is facing is entirely just happenstance. I think that we have been on this collective program of spending more than we have and having people become more and more dependent on the government. We're at a point now where, like Alabama, 2/3 of all people in Alabama are dependent on the government for their day-to-day existence. for them to make it through a day, they have to have government assistance every single day. How can you live where two-thirds of the people in the state can't make it on their own if they're dependent on the government to that degree? And the government needs that. They need people to be dependent on them in order to get reelected, in order to keep job security, in order to keep everything running. They turn to having people become more and more dependent. And it's just like every bureaucratic budget ever. If they have money left over, they spend it, because otherwise they can't make a claim that they need more money. Well, this is the same philosophy. If there are people who are in need, you got to increase it so that there's a lot more people who are in need, so that you have job security and you can increase your funding and increase the tax burden. And so we have this increasing number of have-nots who have no hope. They have no chance to better themselves. They're not looking to get a raise or get a promotion or get a better job to be able to afford nicer things and move up in the social strata. They're looking, they say, the only way I get anything is from the government.
And the have-nots have nothing to lose.
And exactly. The have-nots have nothing to lose. So when it comes time for, you know, unrest, they're not the landed, you know, gentry. They don't have to worry about their farm being taken away. What they're worried about is making it day to day. We're coming up on a commercial break, folks. We'll be right back. When we come back, we're going to discuss a little bit more about martial law and what it means. You're listening to Ready Radio on News Talk 1160, the talk of the town.
And now, back to Ready Radio with Doug and Amy.
Welcome back, folks. When we took our break, we were just getting into what is martial law. And Aaron and I have, during the break, been discussing, you know, the implications of martial law and what martial law means for the vast majority of people. And we said in our first segment that most people don't really even know what martial law is. And so I think it's a good thing to do to actually define it and bring it into focus for people. Martial law is the replacement of civil authority by a military leader. And the reason for martial law is because the civil authority has broken down to the point where they are no longer able to provide either basic goods and services or security. And in what we're looking at, like in Ferguson and other similar events, would be the breakdown of security. When you have rioting and the police force as it stands cannot quell it, it may be necessary to bring in a military force to impose order and stop the rioting. And
let's take away the rioting for a second and time travel back to Boston. Boston was essentially a trial run for martial law, where they shut down the city, imposed time frames where people could only be out on the streets at certain times, and sometimes not at all, remain inside your homes while they searched for fugitives.
We're talking about the moments after the bombing at the Boston Marathon.
That's correct.
And this was a time when, you know, it was a so-called terrorist attack. There was loss of life and limb. People were afraid. There was a huge volume of people out in public. People had come from many different areas for the marathon. It was not just people who lived there, and the possibility of more attacks was very high. So the first thing that was implemented was travel restrictions and curfew, and this pulled people off the streets, placed them where they were away from each other, and allowed the systematic search of the city for suspects or other material that could be used for a terrorist attack. And in a military fashion, this makes a lot of sense. I mean, this is the way you would handle a military campaign, is to isolate the possible of dissidents, to sequester them away from each other, to break lines of communication, to restrict travel, and then to start to search for dangerous implements.
But although it was mostly the police forces, the local police forces, that were in charge of this action, the Boston Police Department, along with many of the surrounding towns, it was also the first time in my recollection that such a thing has been done on American soil in my lifetime.
Well, I don't know, because I remember when Katrina hit, they went door to door and were seizing firearms and removing people forcibly to go to the Superdome. So there was a time there when, and that was, again, local police doing the
action.
That's valid. But they were removing people. Now, there wasn't the kind of travel restrictions that were put in place, and there wasn't an order, return to your homes. That is unique to Boston. But Katrina showed that police departments were willing to go door-to-door and remove people for their own safety, even against their own wishes. And there are lots of stories floating around of people who said that, you know, they had power at their house, they had generators, they had stored food, they were not underwater, they were away from the carnage, and yet they were forcibly removed. And the idea was, of course, if you can this is kind of like the inverse. Katrina was the opposite of Boston, whereas if you can centralize people, you know where they are and you can further evacuate if necessary, whereas if they're all spread out, it's very hard to control them. Well, Boston was, with all the people moving out and around in the street, you can't see what's going on, but by evacuating, clearing the streets, then you know that nobody's moving without authorization. And both of them are means of control of unauthorized access to areas. Either you concentrate people in one place or you disperse them so that they can't have communications and can't move around. But either way, it becomes painfully obvious if somebody is moving around when they're not supposed to be.
Right.
So we've got two examples here now of not martial law, but of police restrictions. And I think that this kind of begs the question, because our police departments are becoming more and more martial in their nature. We look at something as simple as the type of uniforms they have. The police uniforms back, like I mentioned in the first segment, the Norman Rockwell era, you know, the blue uniforms with the copper buttons, you know, that's where the word cop comes from, is from copper buttons. You'll never take me alive, coppers.
Yeah.
Well, you know, that James Cagney said that, but that's the idea was that it was a derogatory term. And I remember getting chewed out when I was first in the district attorney's office because I called him a cop. And my boss was like, don't call him that. I was like, why? Is a derogatory term. Call them officers. It's like, okay, I'll remember to call the cops officers from now on. Got it. So, you know, which got me a little bit of a snide remark. But anyway, they've changed. They're not the community police that they once were. Now, you know, you see the SWAT teams wearing, you know, black with you know, the masks and the helmets. And
they're decked out like SEAL Team 6.
Exactly. And the weapons that they carry, you know, we've moved away. And some of this is, you know, the argument, well, the bad guys have, you know, better guns, so we need better guns too. But we've moved away from the old revolver, which I think was a trusty symbol of American justice, going all the way back to the Old West. And we've moved towards, you know, the MP5, you know, fully automatic 9mm bullet hoses, which are awesome and fun, but I don't really want my police officers walking around with them draped around their neck. I would much rather see a police officer who's looked to be a part of the community. And you know what? I don't walk around with an MP5 or an Uzi hung around my neck on a daily basis, but I do walk around carrying a gun, and I think that it's a normal thing to carry a gun. And when I see a police officer carrying a gun, it's no bigger deal for him to carry a gun than for me to carry a gun. And because we are all free citizens, we are all members of the community, and we are all protecting ourselves and others through our actions. The police are not greater than I am or anybody else who has the responsibility to take care of themselves. They are just in a different capacity. They have been invested with the trust of the community to go and do things that we can't do on a daily basis. If we were a smaller community, maybe we wouldn't need police officers and we could just handle things, you know, privately. But there comes a point when there's enough people that you have to designate someone and say, hey, you, I want you to handle all of these disturbances full time, because the rest of us can't drop everything to come have a community meeting about it every time somebody hits their wife or every time somebody, you know, is abusing their child or every time somebody robs a bank. We can't all drop what we're doing and run to it. We want you to be the one designated person to handle this. Does this mean that they are separate and apart and greater than we are? Not at all. They are a part of us. And they have our trust because we said, you get to handle this. And this is where the whole brotherhood of police officers just rubs me raw, because they're not separate. They are us, and we are them. We have the ability. The whole citizen's arrest idea, I mean, that's intrinsic to what makes America America. We Sorry. Have the exact same powers. We have the exact same authority, and we have the exact same responsibilities as free citizens.
And see, I think that our police departments really need to get the idea to go back to Mayberry. if they could take the policing back to what it was on the Andy Griffith Show, and I know that this is a far stretch from what we have today, but that sense of community, that sense of part of the community, that get to know everyone in your beat, take mm-hmm. care of the people in your beat. If we had that where you only feel like you need one bullet and it can be in your shirt pocket, then America's back to where she should be.
And I know that, to steal a line from Stephen King, the world has moved on. And in a lot of ways it has. And we probably can never regain Mayberry. But shouldn't we strive for it? Even if we can't do it, shouldn't it be the goal? Shouldn't it be the ambition rather than the derision of what we call American policing? And as we look at our bigger topic of martial law, we talked about Boston, we talked about Katrina, we talked about local police forces acting in these ways. I would rather see local police forces not think this way and not do these things. And if it got that bad, for something drastic to have to be brought in like martial law, because Americans are going to recoil against the idea of a military governor far more than they're going to recoil against the idea of a police force now being a SWAT team and the SWAT team now ordering everybody to suspend their civil rights. I would rather see the drastic move of having a military governor step in and saying, all your civil rights are now gone for the duration of this conflict. Because you know what's going to happen when that happens? Good men and women are going to stand up and say, no, this is not that big of a deal. You have no right to do this. No. But when it's the police that we depend on daily, you know, to keep our streets safe, to keep our traffic laws enforced, to keep everything, the trains running on time,
mm-hmm.
when we depend on them for this, and then they turn around and say, no, it's everybody to your homes, you've got to lock yourselves away, people go, well, maybe we need to. I don't know quite what else to do. I think that if the police took a more direct stance and said, no, our role isn't to impose a form of martial law. Our role is to do certain, you know, delineated things. Arrest for crimes we see. Arrest for crimes in which we have probable cause to suspect on a felony level. Investigate when we have a reasonable, articulable suspicion that a crime has occurred. Beyond those three areas, it's not our circus, it's not our monkeys.
So let's take it back to protect and to serve. That's
exactly
where it needs to go.
Exactly. But I think that we've had mission creep now in a very dangerous way. So when we come back, let's talk a little bit more about martial law, if it were really declared, and what it would look like. You're listening to Ready Radio on News Talk 1160, the talk of the town.
And now, back to Ready Radio with Doug and Amy.
Welcome back, folks. So we were talking about martial law and the militarization of police. And I think that this is a very important topic, to something that we can actually prepare for, because a lot of what's going on feels out of our control and that we have no way to really to deal with it. But this is something that we can prepare for in two ways. We can prepare with our security by having the material on hand we need to be able to weather any storm, which is more of the preparedness community idea that we tout every week on this show. And then there's also sort of a legal preparedness, a mindset that you recognize the danger signs of when things are going wrong, and that you are connected enough with other people of like mind and equal beliefs that you can stand up and say no. And that was one of my points in the last segment, you know, Aaron, when I was telling you that the police, we kind of acquiesce to them, but if there was truly a military governor who got up and said, I'm declaring martial law and your civil rights are suspended, people would rebel against that idea.
Oh, of course they would. I mean, who wants their civil rights taken away?
But we see our civil rights be taken away every single day. I mean, they're eroded a little and here and a little there and a little this and a little that. And, I mean, who would have thought 20 years ago that there would be border checkpoints inside the U.S. where people would walk up to your car or your van or your truck and say, are you a U.S. citizen?
And you would have to say, since the day I was born, how about you?
Yeah. You know, the problem is that we've had this slow, it's like boiling a frog. You know, if you throw a frog into a pot of boiling hot water, it jumps right out. But if you put it in a pot of water and slowly turn up the temperature, eventually it'll cook itself. And that's what's happening to America right now, is that the temperature of the water is reaching the boiling point. We're sitting in it. And we've been sitting in it for 50 years, ever since Eisenhower warned us of the coming military-industrial complex that he saw that was going to change the way this world worked and challenged us to stand up against it. From Kennedy standing up to his generals who wanted to bomb Cuba during the Cuban Missile Crisis and saying, no, we're not doing this. We are not starting World War III on my watch. But those were the exceptions, and look what happened. I mean, Eisenhower left office, and Kennedy was assassinated, and the whole system has been on a downward spiral. And as we look at the way the power is going in this country, and here we are now in 2014, on the cusp of 2015, saying, how did we get here? You know, this is not my beautiful wife. This is not my beautiful car. Self, how did I get here? That's one of my favorite songs, by the way.
I'm not even sure what song you're talking about.
Talking Heads, Days Go By.
Okay.
Yeah. Which maybe our wonderful producer can lead us in with on the next segment, because it is an awesome song as we think about, you know, I hope most of our listeners recognize our bumper music at this point. It's been, you know, it's a little bit of an enigma, but I think most people would catch what our theme song is on the show.
R.E.M., It's the End of the World.
As we know it, yeah. Well, I picked that for a very important reason, is I think that our world is changing. And I see that, you know, with riots like in Ferguson and what's going on, I could see the imposition of martial law in the near future. And it frightens me.
Well, when I was watching all the news coverage for Boston, I saw it then. And that was a big awakening point for me, where I went, wow, it's this close. It could happen that fast. Mm-hmm. And what do you do to be prepared for this? I mean, you have to be a little bit emotionally prepared. And I guess watching Boston's news coverage kind of did make me a little emotionally prepared for it. If it were to happen, it wouldn't be as big of a shock as it would have been before Boston.
Well, that's interesting that you phrase it that way, because I think that some of these events are being staged in such a way to help desensitize America. The 24-hour news feed constantly showing you, well, this is normal. This is the way we deal with it.
And it has desensitized us.
TSA. Who, if you had dropped TSA into American life back in the 1950s, right after World War II, How do you think that the American vets returning from World War II would have responded to the idea that they would have to be padded down to go and travel in the United States?
They would have been angered.
They would have revolted.
Yeah.
The Greatest Generation would never have stood for this. My grandfather, when they first started having the TSA and the pat-downs and the scanners, mm-hmm. My grandfather looked at me and said, I'm never flying again. This isn't my country. This is not the country that I fought and my friends died for.
But they do this in the name of protecting us. Really, they're subjecting us.
It's security theater. It doesn't make you any safer. It just is the illusion of something being done. Mm-hmm. And it's conditioning. It's to make you think that being patted down in public and having to go through scanners and metal detectors is normal.
Pay no attention to the man behind the curtain.
I'm reading The Wizard of Oz to my kids right now, and that is very poignant, yes. So, you know, we look at what's going on and we wonder, what do you do? How do you be better prepared for martial law? Well, one of the first things is, as we saw in Boston, it's highly likely that they are going to say, go to your house and don't come out. Well, if you have no food in your house, going to your house and not coming out for an extended period is not a very good thing. If you have no food in your house and you end up in food lines or going to where they're going to be doling out supplies, that's a pretty scary prospect for me. I don't want to have to stand in a food line to be able to provide for my children. I need to have enough supplies on hand to weather a curfew or a travel restriction for a indefinite period of time. And so that brings us back to, you know, the standard prepper answer. Food, water, shelter, way to defend it. So we're talking about food. Freeze-dried food, canned food, rotating your stocks, making sure you have things on hand, making sure you have things that you can cook with in the house that require little energy or heat, because you may have rolling blackouts. There may be a disruption of the power grid. So having an ability to heat up water to rehydrate freeze-dried food in an instant to be able to, you know, make the kids happy. You can have freeze-dried macaroni and cheese hot, ready, piping hot with just Two cups of water and a little bit of heat in under 7 minutes. And this keeps everybody, feeling normal and feeling safe. A lot of this is psychological. You have got to keep your family pulled together during a crisis so that they are comfortable, even in spite of the tragedy that may be going on.
Which is why so many of the freeze-dried foods are comfort foods.
Exactly. And because you're going to be using a lot of calories, in an emergency situation. So having, and this is, we'll get to the True Prep product of the week later, but one of the things that is coming back is seafood chowder. Yeah, and I'm very excited about this because Mountain House discontinued it about a year and a half ago. And everyone's been looking for it. I hear people asking all the time, well, what about the seafood chowder? Because it was amazing. And I know that most people don't think that freeze-dried seafood could be good, but it was amazing. And now it's going to be coming back. In September, I've been told by the owners at True Prep that they've reintroduced it and that they bought up a whole large stock of it and that it's going to be available in number 10 cans. And I am going to be the first one in line to get some seafood chowder. Because it is a comfort food. It's very nourishing and it's got a high caloric content, and you feel good about it after you eat it.
I may have to try this as well.
Yeah, I'll make sure that you get a sample of it, and if I don't buy the entire supply when it shows up. This is really good stuff, and a lot of other things that they're coming out with, too. Well, shoot, since we're talking about it, let's just actually introduce the True Prep product of the week of the new varieties of Mountain House food that are going to be available in September, including Asian fried rice, seafood chowder, and fire-roasted vegetables.
Fire-roasted vegetables.
Yeah, that's a new one. And they're grilled, and they actually have that kind of smoky grilled flavor when you rehydrate them.
That's awesome.
It's really amazing because most of the time when you're dealing, and some people may have charcoal stored up and be able to do charcoal during the apocalypse, but I think most people are going to be dealing with propane or wood burning, and it won't have the same flavors you're used to. Here's a way to incorporate, fire roasted red peppers and yellow peppers and vegetables in such a way that you can make fajitas with them or something else, and really bring back some of the nostalgic, good time feeling that you would have from actually cooking a meal.
Bring back some of your normalcy.
Exactly, which is one of the themes that we've always harped on in this show, is that a return to normalcy.
How normal can we be in an abnormal world?
Exactly. So, they're going to have these new products in. They're coming in early September. There's going to be a sale associated with them. I'm told that it's going to make the sale from last month. And last month, True Prep had an amazing sale where they were offering 25% off Mountain House number 10 cans. These products are going to be at a huge discount because they are brand new products and being brought in to reintroduce them to people. And it's going to be a good time. So I would encourage everybody to stop into True Prep, take advantage of the sales that they have going on, especially the new products that are coming in every week. On that note, getting ready for martial law, having these supplies on hand in your house are very, very important. But the other side of preparing for martial law comes in with networking and having people who are like-minded and of similar belief and able to stand up. I'm working right now in close conjunction to bring in a couple of special guests over the next couple of weeks who are experts in prepper networking. And I want to really, we've had some guests before. Survivor Jane was awesome. She was here and she told how she started her Twitter empire off of an awakening experience. And we've had Dr. Bones and Nurse Amy talk about their outreach program. I'm hoping to get the founder of Survivalist Blog to be here in a couple of weeks. And I'm also talking to people from the American Preparedness Network, which is the largest network of preppers in the U.S. It's an internet-based community where people of like minds come together. And the beauty of this is that when you get to know people, you realize that prepping is not what it's portrayed in the mainstream media. These are not people who are building bunkers and storing up ammunition and trying to take over the world. These are people who are just concerned with the way that America is going and are willing to be active. And the more politically active you are now, the less likely the truly horrific things are going to be.
You can do this inside your church as well. You can do this inside your own community. You can get together with other people who are interested in preparing for emergencies inside your church and work on ways to help other people in your church be prepared.
And that's one of the outreaches that True Prep does very well, is if you have a church in the North Georgia area who's interested in this, True Prep can put on a whole presentation where it doesn't have to be, hey, the world's ending, come buy stuff. Instead, it's, let's have a potluck and we'll have a discussion about tornadoes. And the tornado discussion will open it up so that people can start talking about more preparedness more broadly. And then you can see what the tone is in your church or your synagogue or your mosque and feel what people who have the same belief systems as you are doing. Folks, we're coming up on a commercial break. When we come back for our last segment, we'll talk about other things you can do to be prepared for martial law. And you're listening to News Talk 1160, The Talk of the Town.
And now, back to Ready Radio with Doug and Amy.
Welcome back, everybody. We're talking about martial law and how to be better prepared, not just for martial law, but in general. And when we left, I was kind of on a roll. I was talking, and Aaron mentioned during the break that I was kind of steamrolling here, but I would like to really impress upon our listeners that being politically active is a prep. And this last week, a week ago today, I was at the GeorgiaCarry.org convention, which is a fantastic organization. They do wonderful things to change the laws in Georgia to make Georgia more free and more prosperous. We had their executive director on a few weeks ago, Jerry Henry, a wonderful man, and who talked about how he got involved politically. And this has been one of the themes of this show, is to get involved politically and to make changes so that we don't go down to into this deep hole that's where we're teetering on the precipice of. And I really believe that. I think that we are at a point in our country where I've heard too many times that, you know, it's too late to stop anything and it's too soon to shoot the guys. Well, I don't think we're there yet. I think that it is not too late to stop things. And if we are politically active and if we use our voice and if we, you know, are involved at the local level and start to build up from there, that we can make the changes that'll prevent this from happening. But in order to do that, in order to be there, we have to be involved. We have to be active. We have to make our voice heard. And organizations like Georgia Carry are great for that. They allowed me to come speak. I gave a small speech on being prepared and personal situational awareness, personal security. It was a wonderful time to get to meet and fellowship with good people who believe in personal individual responsibility and liberty. And those are the sorts of things that we need to rally around. There's too many people who get into being prepared and say, well, I don't want anyone to know. I don't want people to know unless they come and steal my stuff. I don't want people to know because they'll think I'm weird. Well, the truth is that if you isolate yourself, then you've minimalized yourself, and you need to be active enough so that you can stand up and say, I want, you know, I think that this is a bad law. I think that this is a bad policy. I think that the police's reaction or way of dealing with the situation was wrong. Shoot, you walk through your life, and there's always going to be incidents where somebody says, you know, well, this wasn't handled right, or this wasn't done right, or something else should have been done. And you've got to have the depth of character to stand up and say, no, we did the best we could, and this is the way it's going to be. Or, look, I understand your complaint, but in the end, this is the way we want things run. And you look at the people who are in politics now, and they don't have the depth of character to stand up and say no to anybody. It's whatever is the flavor of the week, whichever way the wind's blowing. I mean, their index fingers are wrinkled for sticking it in their mouth and holding it up to the wind so often. And what we need is people who are willing to stand in the fray and say, do right. It's so hard to watch this country turn on itself. And Ferguson is a perfect example of that.
Well, see, we have a prime example here of what happens when people forget to use their voices. We were all given a voice. That's the reason we're allowed to go out and we're allowed to vote and we're allowed to speak to our leaders. But people forget to use those voices, and they don't have the ability, they don't believe they have the ability to stand up and say, I don't like this. This is not the way it's supposed to be. This is not the way it's supposed to work. Fix it.
The peaceful protests of the 60s have given way. And that the reason is because there isn't a strong leader anymore standing up saying, we are not going to be violent. You know, Martin Luther King, Gandhi, great leaders of history who preached nonviolence did it because they did not want it to degrade into a police state. And when there's rioting and there's looting, what happens is the government gets more and more power and authority. Mm-hmm. The terrorist attacks of 9/11 led to the government seizing huge amounts of authority and power, taking away liberty in the name of security. And riots like what happened in Ferguson take away liberty and lead to more authoritarianism. We need to stand in the gap and stop that. And the only way to do it is peacefully. We must be peaceful. We must be firm. We must be active. And we must make our voice heard. And the way to do it is not in riots and is not in looting. It's in peaceful protests. It's being involved politically. And all of this could have been taken care of if the people in Ferguson felt they had a voice in their government.
Now, let's separate the riots and the looting for a second. The looting is not a peaceful protest. It's not a political protest at all. It's an opportunity that someone's taking advantage of to get whatever they can for free while the riots are going on.
And I agree with that, but I think that the looting is tied to a lack of political voice as well. Because if they felt that they were socially immobile, if they felt that they had something to lose, they wouldn't be looting. People who there's an anonymity factor, too, because they believe that they're untouchable or won't get caught. But well, that's an important aspect of it.
You also have people who believe they can never do any better. They believe that they're stuck in their station and that there's no hope for their situation. And once again, when you're back to no hope, then these are the things that occur.
And then you have the criminal justice revolving door, where even if you get arrested, you get a slap on the wrist, you come back out, you can do the same thing again. And it becomes commonplace. You want to talk about normalcy. There are places in this country where being arrested and then spending a night in jail is normalcy. And there's no fear of it because it's just what you do. You know, you get arrested for this or that, and there's no consequences for it, really, and there's no stopping it. So it just becomes this, you know, unstoppable force. And that is a way of demoralizing people and bringing them back under control and submission. You have to believe that you can go somewhere with your life. You have to believe that you can do better and be something more. But people have lost that. And as the middle class, through our economic policies, continues to shrink and shrink and shrink, and you have a larger section of haves and have-nots, there's a coming social unrest. And the only way to stop this is to put the brakes on it, revitalize the middle class, get people out of poverty. And you know, one of the scariest things I heard this last year was that Walmart and Target are losing people to Dollar General. Do you know why?
Because people can no longer afford Walmart and Target.
That's terrifying. That is a terrifying prospect, that the discount retailers are losing people because they can't afford to shop at a discount retailer. And yet, you know what section is doing just as good as Dollar General?
Belk's.
Macy's, Belk's, Nordstrom's. Their sales are all up. Haves have more, have-nots there are more of. There's no middle class. And the middle class were Target. The middle class was, you know, those kind of stores. And it's not there anymore. The traditional middle class are bankers and lawyers and doctors. You know, they're not the landed gentry. They're not hourly labor. They're the in-betweens. They're all being soaked up by the government. The doctors are soaked up by the government. The lawyers are soaked up by the government. Everyone is becoming government dependent. Name a job that isn't impacted by the government somehow in this entire country.
They all are.
Everything has mm-hmm. some sort of government ties as the government becomes more and more powerful. And it's a scary prospect. We need to privatize.
You saw the beginning of this, where the haves and the have-nots are beginning to occur in Detroit. When the auto industry started to decline, mm-hmm. the people that were in those auto worker jobs that were in those neighborhoods in Detroit, that lived in those neighborhoods in Detroit their entire lives, they're losing their homes, they're losing their jobs because of the decline of car sales.
And those workers were solidly middle class. Maybe
they were.
Some were a little lower middle class, the younger ones, but the older ones who had been doing the job for 15 years were solidly middle class people, making a lot more money than your average public defender makes as a lawyer.
So using that is an example for the rest of us. When you have a large number of the haves and an even larger number of the have-nots, what happens to the area?
What happens to the tax base? It erodes. They can't provide social services.
So you have bankruptcy in your big cities.
And the whole thing starts to fall apart. And then you have crime. And then you have people trying to get just a little bit ahead. And then you have the despair. And the despair leads to what we're seeing, not only in Ferguson and in Detroit and a whole bunch of cities around this country, mm-hmm. is pure despair. You know, Obama ran on a platform of hope and change. And that was what was resonating with people at the time, because people had no hope. But here we are about to hit the midterm elections in his final term, and people still have no hope. And you know why? Because hope does not come from the government. Hope does not come from the social programs. Hope comes from within. Mm-hmm. Hope has to be that I can see I can better myself. Not a hand out, but a hand up.
And see, we can help each other with hope. But people have to be willing to get their hands dirty and get into their community and spread hope.
Folks, that's all the time we have for this week. Please check us out on Facebook and Twitter and our website at www.readyradio.net. Stop by Troop Prep this week. Get some supplies in case the martial law is declared before next Saturday. But you will hear us here again next week right here on News Talk 1160, the talk of the town.
You've been listening to Ready Radio with Doug and Amy. It's emergency preparedness for everyone. Brought to you by Troop Prep. For all your prepping needs, visit True Prep online at truprep.com or visit a True Prep store in Roswell or Marietta. Tune in each week as Doug and Amy get you ready for anything that comes your way. Ready Radio, Saturday evenings at 5, only on News Talk 1160, the talk of the town.